morning, everybody. Welcome, welcome. You need two sheets today. You need a one-page sheet, and you need a multi-page sheet. They look quite different. One of them says the life and thought of Rav Kook introduction. The other one says the life and thought of Rav Kook number one biographical overview. So you should have no problem telling them apart. Okay, so welcome back, all of those who were here last man, and welcome, I don't know, forward, the people who were here for just for this man. And is it warm in here, or is it me? It's a bit warm. Do you want to open a window? Is the air on? I can't hear it. It's nice and cool outside. If you open the window, it'll make a big difference. Everyone should have oxygen in the room. It's good for your brains as well.
Even if it's cold oxygen?
Yes, especially if it's cold oxygen. Ideal would be cold water, but I can't arrange that in a way which fits with the class, environment. Okay, did everyone get the sheet?
Can I just have one of the one pages? I can deal with myself. Who's got the one page
page? Okay, so can I just check that everybody has the two sheets? Everybody has a one page sheet that says introduction, and everybody has a
multiple pages.
Oh yes, true. She didn't do it back to back. Okay, fine. You're right. It's expanded. You're 100% right. It's not a one page sheet. Okay, fine. Let's start with the introduction, and we'll see how far we get. So I'm giving this class today. Please God, today, tomorrow, Wednesday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. I don't know if I can do Thursday. We're just working out with Yaffa, because I need to be somewhere else this time on Thursday. But if I can switch it in some way, then I will. If I can rearrange things, then I will. But if we get five classes, then the fifth one's a bonus. Okay, fine. Why is it important to talk about Rav Kook? I don't know if you've done any other material this year on Rav Kook or not. I've given you first, on the first part of this sheet, reasons why it's, I think, extremely important to have at least some understanding of Rav Kook. And I've brought you five or six here. First of all, he's one of the most important 20th century Jewish thinkers in Jewish hashkafa, in philosophy, in how we engage with modernity, science, academia, philosophy, these ideas. Not, there are many others. He's not the only one. There are many 20th century important thinkers who do not engage with those issues, but many do. Rav Soloveitchik, obviously, is another very big name who does. But Rav Kook has his own very specific take on these things. He grapples with them. He works with a Judaism and a Jewish community, which is modern in the sense that it is largely secular, exposed to academic secular, influences, college, etc. Even though he was obviously 100 years ago, nevertheless, some things are the same. Secondly, it's important to know about Rav Kook because he is the leader in thinking, in thought, of one of the biggest groups of Orthodox Jews in the world today. Meaning the Orthodox Jewish world can be divided hashkafically, roughly, into a few key groups. There are Hasidim, there are what they might call the Litvaks, the Litvish community, the Haredi community. These overlap with each other, obviously, the modern Orthodox community, but then there's the religious Zionist community, and getting all of those clear in your mind is important, because I know that it's a bit more complex than people, sometimes want to present, and understanding where the circles overlap with each other is also important. But Rav Kook is the father, if you like, in thinking of the religious Zionist community, or one of them. He's not the only one, but he's important. So if you want to understand that world, which is living largely just here, Kiryat Moshe is ground zero for religious Zionist Judaism, Merkaz Arav Yeshiva, etc. So where you are living and learning right now is very important for that. To understand some fundamental issues generally in Hashkafa, what is Kedusha? What does that mean? How does that work? What is Chol? What is Kodesh? What is Kodesh Kedoshim? So these are interesting ideas which Rav Kook definitely has a take on. To hear Torah from a perspective that you've probably never been taught before. If you grew up in the American or English or anywhere outside Israel system, either if you grew up religious and went to a religious school, it's almost certain that you will not have had very much Rav Kook. Over the last 10 years or so, some of the modern Orthodox schools in America have begun to reflect some of the thoughts of Rav Kook, because only over the last 10 years has it began to spread in English a little bit more.
But if you grew up in a more Haredi yeshivish environment, you never heard of Rav Cook, or if you did, you know that he's just like other, okay? If you didn't grow up in a religious environment, but you came through the Kirov system, for want of a better word, it's almost impossible that any of your Rabbonim or teachers had any influence by Rav Cook at all. If you happen to be on campus where there was a JLIC guy who came out of Israel, maybe there. But most of the Kirov world is very clearly coming out of the yeshivish, Litvish, Haredi communities. Nothing wrong with that, but it means you didn't get any Rav Cook, probably, if you went through there. Also to get a perspective on one of the most important events of the last 2,000 years, which is the return of millions of Jews to Eretz Yisrael, that is not something, whatever your religious perspective on that is not something you can ignore. You have to have a take on that. The fact that one of the key things that everybody's been davening for the last 2,000 years has happened in our generation, not everything, but one of the things, that can't be something that you can just like, oh yeah, fine, business as usual. It's just like Poland. No, it's not just like Poland. It's something that's really changed. So Rav Cook will give you one perspective to understand Geula, Mashiach a little bit. We talked about that when we had our classes on the Yud Gimel Ikrim, but we'll talk a bit more about that maybe on Tuesday. And also just to grow an appreciation for depth, quality, creativity, writing, Hebrew. There's many, many reasons to read and understand Rav Cook. That's number one. Why is Rav Cook so difficult to learn? So I brought you six or seven reasons. First of all, his Hebrew, even for Israelis, is very tricky. I'm going to be bringing you sources, some in Hebrew only, but some in Hebrew with translation. To read Rav Cook in English is like chaval, meaning you're missing a lot of the, most of the nuance that's going on there. But to read in Hebrew is very difficult, as I say, even for Hebrew speakers, because he speaks a very flowery, very poetic Hebrew. He quotes constantly from Tanakh. So if you don't know your Tanakh cold, which modern Israelis, certainly religious Israelis, often do know their Tanakh, but if you're not familiar, not just with like the classics like Shmuel and you know whatever, but like your Habakkuk and your Sophoniah, your Yoel and all of that stuff, he's constantly quoting from here and bringing ideas, and if you're not getting them, then you're not getting a lot of what he's saying. He brings extensively from Midrash and Agadah. And not just the famous Midrashim that you heard of, the ones that Rashi brings or the ones they teach in school, but weird, out-of-the-box Midrashim and Agadatas. So to know how to understand Midrash is also critical for Rav Cook. Also, his sources are very Kabbalistic. We'll see in a minute when we go through his life. Today I want to look at his biography. He draws very much on the world of the Zohar, the world of Kabbalistic thought. We'll see how he gets to that. And that also is a world that many people, myself included, don't really understand properly. Many of his ideas spark off 19th century philosophy. He was very, very connected to and aware of the 19th century political and philosophical thinking of his time. So if we're completely clueless about that, we don't always get exactly where he's coming from. Don't forget Zionism, which we'll talk about today a little bit, is also very much a movement of its time. In the late 1800s, many European countries, or were not countries yet, but were part of empires, were beginning to express their own nationalistic ideas. If you're a Czech, or if you're Hungarian, or if you're Ukrainian, or whatever, what's your language, and what's your culture? Zionism is part of that, so Rav Cook also is part of a political and philosophical milieu. One of the reasons it's very difficult is, as I said, almost all the analysis of Rav Cook is in Hebrew. That's beginning to change, slowly. But if you go, for example, to one of the best book sales in Yerushalayim every year, it's just after Pesach. There's a book sale in Mossad HaRav Kook, which is the printing house, the publishing house, which is named after Rav Kook. But then next door in Merkaz HaRav Kook, Merkaz HaRav, in the hall downstairs, in the dining room, there are maybe 12 tables, each at least, I don't know, 200 feet long, of books. Almost all of which are Rav Cook analysis. Or many of which. Most of which. And you realize, you see that, I've got a picture of it. I took a picture you can see afterwards on my phone. Wow, how much has been written about Rav Cook, and almost none of that's in English. So this world is not so available to the people who don't speak Hebrew. And like I said, it until recently hasn't been taught very much, certainly outside the Israeli school system, and of course even within Israel, if you grow up in a more Haredi school, you won't learn any Rav Cook. On the contrary, you'll definitely learn against Rav Cook on certain issues. Right, the last little point on the introduction, if you look on page 2, I've given you some links. I even went through all these links to update the sheet for this year, to make sure that the links were live. I took out some old ones, I put in some new ones. So I brought you some things to get into. Everything on this sheet that you're going to link to is in English. Once you get into Hebrew, if you're a Hebrew speaker, then the sky's the limit. Yeah? But all of this stuff is in English. I brought you some books, which are good to read. These are not links to the books, they're links to where to buy the books. But the book that I most strongly recommend is a book here, Rav Kook, Mystic in a Time of Revolution. Extremely good book. Very, very good biography of Rav Kook. There's a book, An Angel Among Men, which is more a kind of hagiography, more about all of the wonderful things that Rav Kook did in his life, etc. And then there are some other ones. Rabbi Bezalel Naor, who lives in America, is one of the main mouthpieces of Rav Kook's thought in America, in English. He's a very interesting man in and of himself. He's translated many of these things. Rav Moshe Weinberger from Eish Kodesh in Woodmere has translated a very good translation of Rav Kook's works on tshuva, or Rosh HaTshuva, which you don't have to wait for Elul to do tshuva. You can do tshuva all year, you know, get an early bird discount on doing tshuva in Tammuz or Sivan. So he's translated into English a lot of those, and then I've put a few others as well. By the way, there is a 155-page source book on the philosophy of Rav Kook, which you can link on from one of the educators that was in America, now made Aliyah, very interesting fellow called Rav Yosef Bronstein. I brought you the link, and I said, click it before the link, you know, dies somehow or other, because his source book is online, lots of that in English too. I brought you some videos, people like watching movies, some footage of Rav Kook, some movies about Rav Kook, and two very interesting lectures. One by Dr. Henry Abramson, who is an academic and a big Talmud Chacham, which is for an hour on the life of Rav Kook. And another by Rabbi Pini Dunner. Anyone who is from L.A. Should know Rabbi Dunner. Rabbi Dunner is an Englishman. The Dunners are a big English family. And he is himself an incredible person, a very interesting man, researcher. He's the Rav in Beverly Hills, or one of the Rabbon in there. And he gave a two-hour lecture on Rav Kook. I actually listened to both of those this morning on double speed to see the interesting things that they said, and it was amazing. And then I brought you some websites to deal with Rav Kook stuff, and on the back page, on page 3, I brought you some online learning. There are hundreds of shirim on the Gush Etzion website, which is etzion.org. There are many, many shirim on YU Torah, and I brought you some other articles as well from different places, from the Lehr House, which is a journal. Some academic stuff. So there's a lot of, you know, background there. You can go and do, you can spend the whole summer going through this material on Rav Kook. So I want to not just be the limit of your knowledge on Rav Kook, but the beginning of your journey through Rav Kook. So maybe one or two of you might find that worthwhile going through, so I brought that for you there. Okay, good. Let's get into the biography. Feel free to ask any questions, but I think it's extremely important for us to go through a biographical analysis of Rav Kook's life, because it gives you, first of all, a lot of important Jewish history over the last 150 years. Number two, it helps you understand the different hashkafas, certainly in Israel, that are around and how they intersect with each other. And it just makes you aware of things that I think educated Jewish people should be aware of. You know, not everybody can know everything, but, you know, there are certain themes in Jewish history, themes that it's good to be aware of, so that when people, you know, talk about them, you can really connect with them and understand them. Okay, fine. So what I've done, and again, I don't want it to just be me talking, but there are no sources on here. This is just a biography. Yeah, question.
Who is Rav?
We'll talk about that at the very beginning. Okay, I will answer that whole question. It's the question of the shir. Here, Penny, take these. Okay, we will be talking about exactly who he was and how that all works. Fine. Let's start with his birth. Okay, this is quite a big sheet. There's 10 pages. There's lots of pictures. I could have brought you more pictures. It's actually, the copying's come out quite well, so I'm glad that the print has come out well. You can see a little bit here as well. Lots of pictures of Rav Kook through his life, going through from young through to old at the back. Okay, fine. So let's talk about his family. Rav Kook was born in 1865 in a small town in Latvia called Griva. Nowhere else that you probably ever heard of was from there. However, it was quite near to Dvinsk. You've probably heard of Dvinsk, a big Jewish town called Dvinsk. Yeah, you heard of Dvinsk? Sounds a bit like Pinsk and Minsk, but they're all different places. Where are all these places? They're all in what we call Lithuania. And that's the first important thing. Lithuania is not what Lithuania is today. the boundaries and borders of these places were shifting from decade to decade over the last few hundred years. So the area which we now call Lita, or Lithuanian, you heard the word Litvish, it spans the modern day Latvia, Lithuania, some of Estonia, quite a lot of Poland, yeah, the eastern half of Poland, quite a bit of Russia. And there was a big swathe of Russia, Poland, Lithuania, which was called the Pale of Settlement. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Pale of Settlement, but when Catherine the Great took, in the 1700s, took more land to the west of Russia, and there were a lot of Jews there, she said, what are we going to do with all these Jews? So they basically said the Jews are only allowed to live in this area. It was like an enormous ghetto, but it was like thousands of miles long and wide. Very big place, but Jews were not allowed to live in Moscow, in St. Petersburg, in any of these other places, but they were only allowed to live here. So this is in the northern part, the more Latvian part, which is important because it was mostly people who were Lithuanian Jews, like descendants and disciples of the Vilna Gaon. You've heard of the Gaon of Vilna. Yeah, the whole of that crowd. And the only Hasidut, which was up there in the north, most of the Hasiduyot were down in the south, in Ukraine. Yeah, in Poland, Galicia, that's where most of them were. You know how Hasidut works, there was the Baal Shem Tov, originally in the late 1600s, then the Maggid of Meserich, which was his student, and then from there all the Hasiduyot come off there. Ger, and Vishnitz, and Belz, and all of these other Hasiduyot, many, many, many more, were all coming off there. But in the north of the Pale of Settlement, there was one Hasidut which was called Chabad. Okay? Lubavitch. Now, of course, you're all familiar with Chabad. Most Americans are familiar with Chabad. There was this Pew report said that an incredible percentage of American Jews had an interaction with Chabad. Quite remarkable. Not so surprising, but remarkable nonetheless. Anyway, so the only Hasidut that was up there was really Chabad. Interestingly, Rav Kook was the product of what you might call a mixed marriage. His father was a misnagid. Misnagid means they were against Hasidut. The battle between the Hasidim and the anti-Hasidim, the word mitnaged means to oppose, was very fierce in the 1800s because the Hasidim had a lot of very revolutionary ideas, a new emphasis on how to keep Judaism, on certain halachas, etc. And the mitnagdim were very concerned that Hasidut was going to cause Judaism to spiral off into some non-halachic form of Judaism. And therefore there was a lot of tension between them. Somehow or other, Rav Kook's father and Rav Kook's mother managed to make a marriage between a Litvak who was from a Misnagid world and a Chabad Hasidah. So that's already an interesting marriage. Mum and dad are coming from two different places, but somehow managed to make shalom between them. In fact, his mother, Perela Zlota, was herself a relic, if you like, when the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, died, so he left her a little button. She received a button from the coat of the Rebbe, of the Chabad, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And what did she do? When Avram Yitzchak, the little boy, was born, Rav Kook, she sewed it into his kippah, so that above his head all the time would be this button of the Tzemach Tzedek, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe, that would give him pull him up to Shamayim wherever he was going. So that was very interesting. His father's background, as I say, was Litvish. His father learnt in Volozhin, more about Volozhin in a minute. And his father's uncle was one of the early supporters of Aliyah. We'll get to that soon as well. Okay. Also strong in Russia at the time, these are the three big movements you have to know about. Hasidut, the Mitnagdim, and the Haskalah. What is the Haskalah? So during the 1800s in Eastern Europe, the spirit of enlightenment took the form of the Haskalah. They were not so interested in reform. That was a Western European reality. The Western European Jews, the Germans, the French, they were very into kind of adapting Judaism to be more like Christianity, to be more, you know, adapt, to be more suitable to their interaction with the people around them. In Eastern Europe, they were not interested in trying to mix with the non-Jews around them. It was a different kind of non-Jewish kind of crowd. If you're living in German, you feel that the non-Jews living next door are educated, university, conscious, and college. But if you're living in Ukraine, the chances are the non-Jews living next door are not like that. Yeah? To say the least. And therefore, there was very little pulling the Jews of Eastern Europe and Russia to be more non-Jewish in their focus, but they wanted to be more Jewish, but less religious. So the Haskalah is a movement which wants to be very Jewish, and it's Yiddish, and it's Yiddish theatre, and it's Yiddish culture, and it's all about Jews and Jews and Jews. But it's like, but we don't want any of that religious stuff, because we've kind of moved on. We've moved past that. We're more enlightened now. Okay? I can relate to this because my own background was very much from the Lithuanian Haskalah type communities, where everybody was proudly Jewish and they spoke Yiddish, but people were completely clueless and didn't really care that much about keeping mitzvahs. And of course, what happened to the Lithuanian communities is they're almost all just assimilated. As soon as they hit the road on America, in America or in Europe, they were gone. Because the whole ethos of the community in terms of its relationship with non-Jews is that the non-Jews living around you are almost like subhuman, and you just wouldn't want to mix with them. And that's all very well if you're, you know, living in a very, you know, rural Russian reality. But once you hit the ground in Europe and you go to college with these non-Jewish people who are delightful and urbane and pleasant and the kind of people you really want to spend time with, you think, well, like, everything they told me about non-Jews is just nonsense. And then, of course, everyone marries that. Of course, because the whole thing is you can't have a strong Jewish identity by being against other people. You have to have it in yourself. Fine. So the Haskalah was very strong in Russia as well. The idea of being very Jewish without necessarily being very religious. And within the Haskalah, there were different kind of tensions. There was one group that felt that the only way to really keep a strong Jewish-focused community, forget about religion, was by moving to Israel. And therefore there was a group of non-religious Jews who set up something called Chovevei Tzion in the 1860s. This was decades before Herzl. Decades before Herzl. Herzl was Western European. Okay, he was from Austria. But this group was from Russia, and they felt, we need to go back to Israel, we need to go to Palestine, even though it was under Turkish rule, we need to make Jewish life there, Jewish culture there. And there was another group that was very, no, we don't want to be focused on Israel, we want to build Russia, we can go to America, we can do it in America. Think of all the Russians that left in the 1880s, 90s, 1900s. If any of you are Americans here, or Canadians for that matter, have great-grandparents from Eastern Europe, that's when they came, right? So there were some who were focused on Israel, some who were less focused on Israel, but that's the world that Rav Kook was involved in, or was born into. Fine. As a young child, he had a very strong Chabad influence. People say he was very intense, very emotional, very imaginative, very lyrical. He was also a bit cross-eyed as a child. They called him the cross-eyed genius as a small child. Yeah, but he was a genius. They sent him then to Dvinsk. Dvinsk was the nearest big town, of whom half the people were Jewish, and he learned there also under Rabbonim, and then he went into a more Hasidic environment, and then he mixed with some relatives who were more from the Haskalah. So you see, as a teenager, he's picking up all of these things from different places, Hasidut from his Chabad connections, and Litvish analysis and Torah learning from another side, and then the Haskalah, broad-minded academic influence. He's picking all of this up. Yes, Penny? Their big thing, the Lithuanian Jewish community, their big focus was learning. Learning in yeshiva, learning to the highest possible level, analysis, Gemara. Well, who's Rabbi Reuben Levin? Oh, yeah, here, rather the apprenticeship. I don't know much about Rabbi Reuben Levin, but that, yes, that world that he lived in was very Litvish. The big kind of mothership of all of the Lithuanian Jewry at that point was the yeshiva in Volozhin, which we'll see Rabbi Kook spends some time in. But who was founded Volozhin? We just actually had his 200th yahrzeit. Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner in the early 1800s, who was a main Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. He took the vision of the Vilna Gaon, which was to create a community of Talmidei Chachamim. So you have to understand, through most of Jewish history, only a small proportion of the Jewish men, even the men, forget about the men became literate and Talmidei Chachamim. They say that in the 1800s there was around a 60% literacy for Jewish men, which was much higher than the world around them, even the nobility around them, but it's still 60%. And of that 60%, very few were able to go to yeshiva. There was no yeshiva organizations. You went to a nearby town, you learned with a rabbi, three or four of you, they didn't have any dorms, they didn't have any kids. Volozhin was an idea when it was set up in the early 1800s to make a whole yeshiva as an institution. You have hundreds of boys from all over the world, and you have kitchens, and you have boarding, and you have dorms, and you have arrangements and organization, etc. Okay? So Volozhin was the mothership, and by the way, just like I said, from Chassidut, all the other Chassiduyot broke out, so from Volozhin, you can trace the pyramid of all the yeshivas. And the chances are most of your rabbis, either here or before, were from the Litvish world. Those yeshivas being Mir, and Ponovich, and Slobodka, and Navardok, and Radin, and then Chevron, and in the modern world, Yeshiva University is part of that, and the Gush, and the etc. Okay? Someone had a question? Yes.
No,
because Rabbi Volozhin wasn't alive by then, but Volozhin he's going to get to in a few minutes. We're going to get that. But his early life was like a patchwork of different kinds of Hashkafic influence, and he really imbibed that. At 18, he met with a very important person called the Aderet. Here's a picture, this first picture on the page. The Aderet became his father-in-law, Rabbi Eliyahu David Rabinovitz Turumim, who eventually himself ended up in Israel. We'll talk about how that was. And he was betrothed to his eldest daughter, Batsheva Alta, and they were a young married couple. And now, as a married man, he went to Volozhin. So if you go over the page to page 2, Volozhin, as I said, is called the mother of all yeshivas.
Okay, here's my question.
Yes.
Is it still going to be like his mentor,
Yes, yes. The Vilna Gaon already was died before Volozhin was set up, but Rav Chaim Volozhin, who's, as I said, his Yortzeit is 1821, he died. So this was just the 200th anniversary a couple of weeks ago of his Yortzeit. So by the time Rav Kook's going there in the 1880s, it's a very established yeshiva. The Nefesh HaChaim was Rav Chaim Volozhin, correct. And therefore, much of the Hashkafa of modern-day non-Hasidic Haredi Judaism, the Litvish Haredi Judaism, is all coming out of that yeshiva world. So Rav Kook is now married. The Volozhin is full of intellectuals, very eclectic. Of course, it's got mostly Mitznagdim. A few Hasidim managed to creep in, yeah? And a few Maskilim managed to creep in as well. Because some of these more secular-oriented guys are themselves geniuses. Some of the people, I put a list of alumni that include in there. Rav Bengis, we'll come back to him in a minute. He was a very close friend of Rav Kook. The Netziv, obviously, was the Rosh Hashiva. You've probably heard the name, the Netziv. He was the Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin through the period that Rav Kook was there and a long time before. The Netziv had two sons, both of whom were products of Volozhin. Rav Chaim Berlin, you may have heard of Chaim Berlin, Yeshiva Chaim Berlin. Chaim Berlin was a very important figure. And then his younger brother, Rav Meir Berlin, who changed his name to, when he moved to Israel, Meir Bar Ilan. And Bar Ilan University was founded in honor of Rav Meir Berlin, Bar Ilan, etc. Very interesting. Bialik, the poet laureate of Israel, secular poet laureate, totally secular, was a Talmud at Volozhin. Okay? Many other people here, Torah Tamim, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, the first and last chief rabbi of New York, that's the whole story in and of itself. Rav Kook, Rav Baruch Leibovitz, who later was in Israel, very important figure. Rav Aryeh Levine, the Tzaddik of Yerushalayim, who later came to Yerushalayim, he was there, Rav Itzhak Zalman Meltzer, Rav Reines from Religious Zionism, very important, Rav Zundel Salant, much earlier, Rav Shimon Shkop, Rav Achonon Vassanon. This reads as the great minds of, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century Judaism. Fine. So he was a Talmud there, he was very close to Rav Kook. By now he was married, he was a 19-year-old married, not Rav Kook, to the Netziv, he was very close to the Netziv. They were they had a very strong bond. Rav Kook learnt from 7 a.m. to midnight every day. He was unusual. He was hard to box, even as a young man. First of all, he had a beard. Like, nobody had a beard. We mentioned this before, right? Nobody had a beard. Even the Rosh Yeshiva just about had beards. But it was considered, like, unusual, presumptuous almost, to allow your beard to grow. It made as if you were a Talmud Chacham. So everybody was clean-shaven, the Bocharim. Even into the 20s and 30s, Rav Kook had a beard, which is unusual. He spoke to people in Hebrew, which was weird, because the only people who spoke Hebrew were the Maskilim, who wanted to reinvent Hebrew.
What's the Maskilim?
The Maskilim, the intellectuals, the secular intellectuals. Okay? Haskalah. Haskalah is from the word Sechel. Sechel means intellect, right? So the Maskilim were from Sechel. So he was very into learning Tanakh. I think I mentioned before some interesting things about him. He was very mystical, even as a young man. I mean, that may have been the Chabad influence going through his veins. The other guys in the yeshiva found that every now and then, when he was standing by his shtender, he was looking underneath his shtender at something underneath his shtender. And I mentioned this to you before, and they reported him to the Netziv. They said the equivalent of his checking his emails. They said he's reading the newspaper. They said he has a newspaper or he has secular books underneath and he's peeping at them and pretending he's learning. So the Nitziv said, I don't want to hear Lashon Hara, he's our star student. So they didn't let him alone, and he locked these things up in his shtender. So they broke into his shtender to see what he had in there, and it turns out he had little parchments with the names of, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, mystical names that he was looking at to get kavanas as he was learning Gemara. Interesting person. Fine. He received the smicha from Rabbi Chil Michal Epstein, who is also the Aruch HaShulchan, also a very famous person, and brother-in-law of the Nitziv. So he really is coming out of the top yeshiva with the top smichas from the top guys. He was no question extremely eminent in that sense. Fine. As I said, he married the daughter of the Aderet. He studied with his father-in-law. He studied Kabbalah. One of the people he studied Kabbalah with, by the way, is someone called the Leshem. These are people who you may or may not have heard of. The Leshem was the grandfather of Rav Eliashiv. Rav Eliashiv, who lived here in Israel, one of the major figures who died maybe, I don't know, 6-7 years ago now. His grandfather was the Leshem, so Rav Kook learned Kabbalah with the top Kabbalists. Yes?
Why did they wait 2 years to get married? Was he like 14?
Yeah, probably. I don't know exactly. You can check that out. But they all married young. Rav Shmuel Salant, who will come to soon, he was the main leader of the old Yeshiva in Yerushalayim, he got married on his bar mitzvah. It's a way to save on the caterers. Yeah. I mean, Rav Shmuel was even older than Rav Kook. He must have got married when he was like in the 1840s. It was a different world then, you know? They were all young. By the way, you know, most people lived till they were about 40, 45, and most women died in childbirth, or a very large proportion of them anyway. In England at this time, 1/3 of all women died in childbirth. So you didn't wait till you're 35 to start looking for a shidduch, you know, because you started early. Fine. Okay, so he was writing a lot. He wrote in different kinds of journals. He contributed articles not only to the Torah journals, but also to the Haskalah journals that made people think, like, why are you writing for those? He's a young man, but he really tries to involve himself in all of the areas that he defended the Nitziv. The Nitziv himself was criticized for being too open. If you read the Nitziv's commentary on Chumash, it's one of the most and probably the last great creative commentaries on Chumash. Yeah, the Nitziv is extremely unusual. Really, since the Nitziv, all people have been doing really to a large degree is collecting what other people say and making anthologies. There are a few exceptions, but the Rav Kook was very into the Nitziv. He defended the Nitziv. Very poor. Says that they had 6 chairs, they had no beds, and they took it in turns to sleep. Imagine being in a family where all you had was 6 chairs and you slept for a couple of hours and she slept for a couple of hours, and that's how they did it. The Chofetz Chaim, how did he know the Chofetz Chaim? Because the Chofetz Chaim was a frequent, or at least somewhat frequent, guest in the home of his parents in Griva. Imagine if the Chofetz Chaim was someone who used to come to you for Shabbat. So the Chofetz Chaim, he met the Chofetz Chaim when he was a little boy, and the Chofetz Chaim said to him, listen, you're a big Talmud Chacham already, you're only 18, 19, you're a married man, get a job as a Rav. You know, you can't sleep on chairs for the whole of your life, you have Torah to give, go out and earn a little bit of money and keep your family and be fine. So he got his first position in a place called Zaymel. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it exactly right. He started his own Torah journal, something called Itur Sofrim, filled with his own ideas, on prophecy, on the Sanhedrin. He also said that his journal was there to connect all sorts of different kinds of hashkafas so that all Jewish people could be together b'shalom. See, even as a young man living in Russia, he felt that he wanted to bridge between different kinds of hashkafas, and so he started this journal. It didn't succeed. Rav Kook was a brilliant thinker, but not a brilliant organizer. All the big projects that he started, almost all of them failed in his own lifetime when he moved on to something else. Because he didn't know how to kind of organize, he needed an organizer to do that. Tragically, his wife died, she had pneumonia, he had a baby daughter, and he left off the journal because he was now a single parent trying to look after a baby. The story is that the Shiva, he was sitting Shiva, and his father-in-law, the Aderet, was sitting Shiva with him. His father-in-law turned around to him at the Shiva and said, listen, I'm an old man, Nebuch lost my daughter, but you're a young man, you need to get married to someone else. You can't. So Rav Kook says, yes, of course, in due course. He says, no, not in due course, I have a shidduch for you, for the shiva. He says, so the Aderet had a twin brother, and the twin brother had a daughter. So he says, you should marry her. She's not the first wife, but she'll be the second wife. And he married her, and that was a very successful shidduch, and they had three more children. They had Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who later became Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who was their only son, a daughter called Esther Yael, who Nebach fell off a roof later on and died as a small child, and Batya Miriam, who went on to marry Rav Ra'anan. The family had a lot of tragedy in it. Rav Tzvi Yehuda himself never had children. Esther Yael, as I said, died very young. His other daughter, his oldest daughter, never had children. Batya Miriam did have children, but one of her children was killed by an Arab terrorist. One of her children died in a drowning accident. And the story goes that Rabbi Aryeh Levine in Yerushalayim at a certain point convened a kind of quorum of Talmidei Chachamim, and they said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, enough tragedy for the family of Rav Kook. He has no grandchildren right now, he has no descendants, they should be, please God, Simcha Mav. And then they started to all have babies and things, and he has descendants. My son in Merkez HaRav, when he was in high school, was in Merkez HaRav with a great-grandson of Rav Kook, and there are Rav Kook children running around. There are lots of cousins as well, Kook families, but they're all cousins rather than direct descendants. Fine. So he's in Zimel. It's a small town. He has lots of time to think, lots of time to write. The advantage of being a rabbi of a small town is that there's not much to do. You know, a few shilas here and there. Rav Hirsch, by the way, had the same thing. Like 70 years earlier in Germany, his first job was, I think, in Oldenheim. Somewhere like that, and there was nothing to do there. So he spent his time writing. The Rav Kook also, a lot of writing there. He went around Lithuania, preaching anonymously, etc. He wrote different things, and he was very, very strongly influenced by the Ramchal. Who were the major influences on Rav Kook's thought? The Maharal, the Ramchal, yeah, these Kabbalistic Lithuanian, early Lithuanian, and then the Ramchal himself, very sui generis, and of course the classics of Lithuanian and Chabad thinking as well. Go on. One of his own. The only one like the Ram. There was no one like the Ramchal. The Ramchal was a very interesting person, not his true Rav Kook. The Ramchal lived maybe 130, 40 years before Rav Kook. And if you would have predicted in the time of the Ramchal who is going to be one of the biggest accepted, you would have never predicted the Ramchal. They were mamash burning his books when he was alive. They thought he was totally off the wall, but the Ramchal managed to be liked by everybody. Yeah, the Hasidim adopted the Ramchal, and he was like proto-Hasidic. The Hasidus very much braces many of its ideas. The Vilna Gaon became a massive Talmud of the Ramchal's thinking. He said he would have crawled on his hands and knees to see the Ramchal in Italy if only he would have been able to. He was obviously dead by then. He died at 40, the Ramchal. Okay, he's buried in the Tveri up in the north here. And the Maskilim loved the Ramchal because he wrote in Hebrew. He wrote theater. Religious theatre.
Like
right, so everybody loved the Ramchal. So Rav Kook was very into the Ramchal too. Fine. Next, Boisk. He moved to Boisk, a bigger town, to be the Rav of Boisk. He was caught up in a big debate about Musa. And here you have to understand another theme of mid to late 19th century Judaism. What is the Musa movement? Really founded by Rav Yisrael Salanter. The idea that people have to be taking real time to work on themselves, work on their middos, work on their, you know, personal growth, and not just learning Gemara and hope that the Gemara will somehow impact them. Because, you know, men are pretty bad at that. Men can learn a whole gaff of Gemara about the terrible nature of Lashon Hara and then walk out of the room and speak Lashon Hara. Women are usually more connected with what they're learning and say, like, we've just been learning about this for the last hour. How can you just, like, men are sometimes a bit, like, out of it. They've got segments. Musa was very much about holistically joining it all together. So Rav Kook was very involved in that as well, whether people should work on Musa or less or whatever. There's a big debate on that. Now, still in the Lithuanian yeshivas today, Musa is a... I remember I was in a very Litvish yeshiva in Israel here, Israeli yeshiva. The Musa Seder was like 10, 15 minutes before lunch. It was not really serious, you know? But, okay, fine. Different things on that. Rav Kook wrote originally in a very stream of consciousness style. He wrote a bunch of notebooks, which are called the Pinkasim. A Pinkas is a notebook in Hebrew. And when you read these, they're very much his kind of, the ebb and flow of his thought. And he was very keen on trying to publish things the way that they first kind of came out. And later on, his son and his main Talmidim said, you can't do that. People can't sit and read these because they're just like your brain on fire, like, you know, here and there and everywhere. So they later tried to systematize it. But Rav Kook was not such a systematic thinker. He had brilliant ideas. But now those Pinkasim are all published. And people learn them. They're very difficult because obviously it's his thoughts and his Hebrew, half the words he makes up, because there are no Hebrew words there. This is pre-Ben Yehuda. There is no Hebrew. He's writing in a language that he's creating as he goes through. A little bit like L'Havdil Shakespeare. Shakespeare invented thousands and thousands of words that he didn't find in English that were there. So that's why, you know, Shakespeare becomes an interesting thing to read. Were you sitting there? Okay, you can sit next to her, whatever. You can move to the front, whatever. I just don't want you to be sat on in a minute. Okay, fine. Let's go on. Rav Kook wrote the first part of his commentary on the Agadita. That was also unusual, not unique, but on the Midrashic part of the Gemara. He only got as far as Brochas and Shabbat, which are the first two, but Rav Kook's commentary on the Agadita is very important. Now, enter Herzl. Okay, so Herzl was Austrian. He was a newspaper journalist, and he went, he very assimilationist. He was completely non-observant. He was many generations assimilated. Okay, he was Jewish, his mother and father were Jewish, but they were not practicing in any real way. They didn't keep kosher, they didn't keep Shabbat, they didn't keep anything. And he really felt that the answer to the Jewish problem was for everyone to convert to Christianity. That was his first main, approach in life. Then he went, this is oversimplified, but, then he went to France as a journalist. He was about 30-something years old, maybe 35, and he covered the Dreyfus trial. Albert Dreyfus was accused by the French of being a German spy. This was in the lead-up to the First World War. This was about 15 years before the First World War, a bit more. Dreyfus was Jewish, very assimilated, but the French just, like, in a frenzy, turned on the Jews. Now, the French, this was 100 years after the French Revolution. When was the French Revolution?
1803,
no? No, the French Revolution. Before, 1789, I think.
Yeah.
This was in 1900 something, okay? 1895. French was 1895. So it was 100 years after, and the French Revolution was meant to even out all of these things. Equality, liberty, brotherhood, fraternité, l'égalité, and all that. And the Jews were meant to be part of that. So all of a sudden, because Dreyfus was accused, falsely, by the way, of being a spy, and sent to Devil's Island and all that, and they were marching through the street saying, death to the Jews, and the Jews, and the Jews. So Herzl was completely shocked. He said, look, I expect this in Ukraine. But in Paris? This is nuts! And he realized that there's never going to be a solution for anti-Semitism unless the Jewish people just leave all these people behind and go and make their own country. And this is where he wrote the Judenstaat, which is the idea of the Jewish state, and he set up, 2 years later, the first Zionist Congress. Yes?
What incorporated the Devil's Island?
What do you mean? Devil's Island was a place where they sent the worst of all prisoners, somewhere in the Pacific, where you just can never escape from. But eventually, Dreyfus was acquitted. There's also a Emile Zola. I don't know if you've ever studied French literature. Emile Zola was a non-Jewish writer at the time, and he wrote into the papers J'accuse against the French government in favor of Dreyfus, because there were a lot of French intellectuals that also were very shocked by the anti-Semitism that burst out from nowhere, as they think. That's always the way, right? Mm-hmm. You always think it's all gone, and then all of a sudden it all bursts out again. Fine. Okay, so Herzl, if you think about it, this is incredible. From being a newspaper reporter, 2 years later, he organized in Basel, I think it was in Switzerland, the first Zionist Congress of hundreds of people to start the idea of Zionism. Now, Rav Kook was living still in Eastern Europe. He was not, in that sense, a Zionist in that sense, although he was very connected. Boyce, where he was a rabbi, the rabbi prior to him had been one of the supporters of Chovevei Tzion, this early movement to try and bring Jews to Israel, yeah? So Rav Kook was also basically in favor of that, but then his mind was turned to Zionism, secular Zionism, which started here. So always remember that secular Zionism from Herzl started a few decades after what became religious Zionism, the idea of going back to settle the land, but the religious Zionism was not political. Herzl wants to make a state. He wants to go around collecting support from all of the major players in European politics and philanthropy, Rothschild, etc., etc., and try and create a Jewish state. He didn't want it to have anything to do with God, because he's not religious. So you can understand why most of the religious world were very, very nervous about Zionism, secular Zionism. Because first of all, it was working to undermine everybody's communities, take all the Jews out and send them to Israel. And secondly, it was divorcing Judaism very strongly from God, and in that sense was one of the classic late 19th century movements where the Jews took on other idealisms other than religious life. Communism, Bundism, Reform, with conservatives a bit later. Zionism was another one of these, so it's not surprising that most of the religious world was very, very worried and nervous about Zionism. And it's really Zionism that brought together the Mishnagdim and the Hasidim. Because having fought with each other through the whole of the 19th century, they woke up at the beginning of the 20th century and said, gosh, we've got to fight this, and we've got to fight it together. Because this is more dangerous to both of us than anything else. And that was the, you know, what brought them together, yes.
Why is it that you think that the secular Zionists succeeded,
yes,
the religious ones did?
Well, it depends on what you call succeeded. The religious Zionists were never trying to establish a political goal. They were trying to get people to move to Israel, to live Jewish lives more authentically in Israel. It's a myth. Everyone agrees it's a myth to live in Israel. Secular Zionism succeeded, I think, through a series of almost miraculous coincidences, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. But they weren't, of course, coincidences, and Rav Kook was wrapped up in them. We must go on. We have a lot to do. We're only in Boisk, and we have 25 minutes to go. Sorry. In Israel at the time was a very interesting man called Rav Yoel Moshe Salomon. There is a street named after him, downtown Yerushalayim. He was a printer. He was himself a religious man, and he was approached by the Aderet, who was Rav Kook's father-in-law, who was living in Yerushalayim. The Aderet was brought in by Rav Shmuel Salant. I don't know if you'll remember all of this, but Rav Shmuel Salant, who was the head of the old Yishuv, was very worried that he was very old, and there were lots of what he considered more extremist figures trying to take over the old Yishuv. When I say the old Yishuv, I mean the almost entirely religious group of Jews who were living in Israel, mostly in four cities, which were Yerushalayim, Tzvat, Tveria, and Hebron. There was almost no, agricultural presence. The first agricultural settlements, like Petach Tikva, okay, which was set up by Rabbi Yoel Moshe Salomon, yeah, Rishon LeZion, where else? What's the place next to Sfat? No. No, no. What, no, no, I can't remember the name of the little town there. It'll come to me in a minute. But anyway, a lot of these little agricultural ones were the new Yishuv. Not the old Yishuv. The old Yishuv was in yeshivas. They had no money. They lived off the what they called the chalaka, which was the handouts of money collected in Chutz La'aretz and sent to Israel. That was the old Yishuv. Okay? So the old Yishuv brought in the Aderet to try and, you know, lead it. But the Aderet died quite young. But in the meantime, before he died, Rav Yoel Moshe Salomon said to the Aderet, we're trying to find a new rabbi to take over in the town of Jaffa. Now, where's Jaffa? Where's Jaffa? It's on the port, okay? Jaffa was not one of the main Jewish towns. Jaffa was mostly, A, Arabs, still is, B, secular Jews, still is, okay? There was a small Jewish group there. They had a rabbi that was sent there, or was like a Kirov rabbi, to be Makarov some of these, like, Jews in Jaffa. He died, and they said, we need somebody to take over. And the Aderet said, my son-in-law. My son-in-law is the man. Persuade him to come from Boisk to Jaffa, and he'll be the rabbi of Jaffa, and he'll be a great Kirov Rav. He will reach out to the people there, fine. So Rav Kook took a lot of persuading. He didn't really want to leave Boisk. He was doing well in Boisk, but they managed to persuade him. He accepted the job. He left for Jaffa in April, and he arrived in May. There are all sorts of reports of, it took a month to get to Israel, right, in those days. You had to kind of trek on road down to the Black Sea and then get a boat down. There are all reports of how the town came out with him and cried, please don't go, Rabbi, please don't go, and he went. So he became the chief rabbi, probably the only rabbi, the only main rabbi, in Jaffa. Now, as I said, Jaffa was a town of a few thousand Jews, mostly non-religious, quite a lot of Arabs, but this was the beginning of the Second Aliyah. Now, what's the Second Aliyah? The Second Aliyah began at the beginning of the 1900s, mostly non-religious people. The first Aliyah, which set up Rishon LeZion and Petach Tikva and those places, was mostly religious Jews. We'll get to Shemitah in a minute. Okay? But the second Aliyah was mostly Russians, mostly secular, like Ben-Gurion, who wasn't, of course, called Ben-Gurion then. His name was Green. Gun. His name was David Gun. So he named it to David Ben Gurion. Ben Gurion was fanatical about people having Hebrew names. He didn't let people have Russian sounding names if he could help it. But the second Aliyah sets up lots of what they called moshavot, little secular agricultural settlements all around Israel, little tiny ones, okay, including the first kibbutzim, the first kibbutz, which was Degania up by Tveria, was set up around then. And when Rav Kook came to Jaffa, they turned around to him, the Adari said to him, okay, you're not only the rabbi of Jaffa, but you're the rabbi of all of these little yeshuvim, this little moshavot, they call them. So he was a kiruv rabbi. His job was to reach out to these people, go to them, because they were completely secular. Totally secular, and that was his job. Okay, fine. So he got to Yafo, and his job was to reach out to these left-wing, mostly non-religious nationalists, call themselves, we are the last Jews and the first Hebrews. It was this return to a completely, you know, a biblical, but completely non-religious, non-rabbinic, we're Ivrim, we're not Hebrews. There was even a group that wanted to call themselves Canaanim, with like the Canaanites. Okay? There's a whole thing. Now, Theodor Herzl died. We'll get back to that on Tuesday when we look at the Hesed that he had to give. We did that before, but we'll do it again on Tuesday in a slightly different way. And then they persuaded Rav Kook to take a trip around the Moshavot. He was the rabbi of these people. So these stories of him, you know, going like a road trip around Israel in like 1904, 1905. And he's saying, oh, quote, a Jewish cow. He says, a Jewish cow. You can't believe it. Because like in where he came from in Lithuania, the Jews didn't own land, and this was a new renaissance. He says, I could kiss every stone in the land, even the donkeys I could kiss as well. He met one of the young Talmidei Chachamim in Yerushalayim, Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. Here, look at the picture of Rav Charlap down on page four, on the sort of middle left. That's Rav Charlap. He became a major figure in Rav Kook's life, a big, big Talmud of Rav Kook, someone who the religious Zionists study very strongly. There's a picture of Rav Kook at this time himself in his 40s. Fine. At the same time, Eliezer ben Yehuda was forming Hebrew. He was also fanatical in his own way about Hebrew, very excited about the idea, quote, all of us, said ben Yehuda, have turned our backs on the past. This is our glory and splendor. He wrote a paper upon this. This was when the Uganda plan was being discussed as well. Should we go to Uganda instead of to Israel? And Rav Kook hit back, and he said, no, you're wrong. But he wanted to welcome Ben Yehuda at the same time as disagreeing with him. He was quite connected with Ben Yehuda. He disagreed with him strongly because Ben Yehuda wanted to turn their back on religion completely. Ben Yehuda was in favor, look, as I said, we have all turned our back on the past. We don't want anything to do with Judaism from the past. We have a new... But Rav Kook disagreed fundamentally, but he wanted to, you know, befriend him in that sense. He didn't want to cut ties with him. There's a story of the last time that they met, and he said, every time he met Rav Ben Yehuda, he kind of jokingly said to him, when are you going to do tshuva? Eliezer Ben Yehuda, whatever he called him, Laser, I don't know what he called him, Mr. Ben Yehuda, no idea. He said, when are you going to do tshuva? And he always said, leave me alone, leave me alone, leave me alone. And then the last time they met, he said, when are you going to do tshuva? And he said, I don't know, maybe. Yeah, and then shortly after that, he fell down the stairs and broke his neck and died. And Rav Kook said, as far as he was concerned, he died of Baal Shuvah. That was it. That was the first time he ever said maybe. And then he died after that. Okay, fine. Some of the issues that Rav Kook started to get involved in began to draw attention to him that was not positive. Don't forget, the old yeshuv looked at Rav Kook with some real concern. Who is this man who speaks Hebrew, befriends the secular Jews, knows Haskalah? They couldn't doubt his Torah learning. His Torah learning was untouchable, but they didn't trust him. At the same time, the secular Jews also didn't trust him because he was very religious, intensely religious, and that was not the kind... Yeah, but not just he had a beard, he was a representative of everything they're running away from. You don't forget, the secular Russians were not just running away from Russia. They were running away from Torah. They want to start afresh in a new place. For example, there was a very secular school that was set up in Yafo, and Rav Kook didn't agree with it, but on the other hand, he didn't oppose it. He said you could say two brachas on this school. One is the bracha which you say when you see Avodah Zorah. You see that you hope that God will take Avodah Zorah away from the land very quickly. He says you can make that bracha on the school at the same time as you're making the bracha Matzid Gvul Almana, which is when you reestablish something Jewish in the land of Israel, like a shul, a community, you make a bracha, praise Hashem, of the reestablishment of Jewish, you know, identity in the land. So he said, this is a school on which I will make the both of those brachas. That's Rav Kook. That's the conflict that he faced. Over to page 5. He started off his own, much more moderate Orthodox school, but with a secular syllabus. That was also quite unheard of in Eastern Europe.
In Western Europe, Rav Hirsch had been doing this for decades.
Yeah, Rav Hirsch and his Talmidim. Rav Hirsch died in the 1880s. So in Western Europe, it was very standard for Jewish frum schools to have secular subjects, science, history, philosophy, etc. But in Eastern Europe, math. In Eastern Europe, they didn't. And certainly not in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, it's like, you're not allowed to teach secular topics. Rav Kook said, no, as long as it's done in a traditional way, he was in favor of that. He said he not only that, but he actually wants to make a whole new yeshiva, which has a joint syllabus. He says, my vision for a yeshiva is we're going to learn Gemara, and we're also going to learn science and technology and history and philosophy. That never happened. In the end, Hebrew University, Rav Kook hoped, would turn into something like that. That didn't happen either. But Merkaz Harav and Hebrew University kind of just became a secular university and a yeshiva, as opposed to the vision that he had for a mixture, but there are other ways in which that came to fruition. I brought you some of the key academics at the time, key intellectuals, I should say, at the time, people you've heard of, some of them Shai Agnon, Yosef Chaim Brenner, you probably haven't heard of, Aaron David Gordon. These are all people who are very much part of the early secular life of Israel. Okay, in 1909, Rav Kook had to deal with the reality that a little town was set up just north of Yafo, of which he was also de facto the chief rabbi, because he was a suburb of Yafo, called Tel Aviv. Okay? And that was completely secular. They set up their own town. You've got this picture of them all on the sand dunes. You've seen that picture? Of them taking lots for who's going to have which sand dune? People said, you guys are just out of your mind. You know, you want to move out of Yafo onto sand dunes where nothing grows, where you can't even build houses properly because it's all sand, where there are Arabs taking, like, sniper shots at you from Jaffa. Like, who in their right mind would pay money for a piece of land in Tel Aviv? Yeah? 100 years later. You never know what's going to be in 100. No one would have ever predicted Tel Aviv today from Tel Aviv then, and therefore you can say that about many places. Okay, a few very important controversies. Number one, the sesame oil controversy. What's all this about? Rav Kook came out and said he felt that kitniot on Pesach should not prohibit derivatives of kitniot. He felt that kitniot applied to the actual vegetables themselves, the beans, the pulses, whatever, the peas, the rice, but not to the oils that came from them. Now you might think this is a rather sort of arcane amuse, but it became very controversial, because the old yeshuv dug in its heels and said, no, kidney art is like almost like chometz, not chometz, but it's whatever. So this became something on which they agreed with him halachically. It was a long, heated debate, never back down, and still is today, by the way. If you want to know the difference between Coca-Cola and Diet Coke on Pesach, why one has an Eidah Haredis Badat Hefsha, and why one only has a regular Rabbanut Hefsha, yeah? Diet Coke only has a Rabbanut Hefsha. Regular Coke has a Badat Hefsha. It's because of this. It's because there is an ingredient in Coke which is the derivative of a kidney, da 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 da. And the regular Rabbanut says good enough, and the Badat says not good enough. So, you know, that's not the biggest deal in the world, right? Whether you drink Diet Coke or Coke, but it was one of the things that blew up. The next one that blew up was Shemitah. Let me give you a little bit of background. It's important you understand this too. All of these things you could have a series on in themselves. What's the deal with Shemitah? Every 7 years, says the Torah, the land has to be left completely fallow. You can't plant, you can't work the land, you can't prune the trees, you can't harvest the crops. You can eat the stuff that grows. We'll have maybe some shiurim on, you will, I don't know if I give them, on Shemitah as we go through. Not now, but you know, when it becomes Shemitah. This is Shemitah starting in September, right? So you're here, if those of you who are here next year for Shemitah. So Rav Kook have to deal with the reality that now there are a lot of agricultural yeshuvim in Israel. Where does the whole Shemitah controversy come from? That in the early days, when the first yeshuv was dealing with the first Shemitah, which was 1888/89, So you count forward 7 years, 7 years, 7 years, 7 years, 7 years, you'll get to 2021/22. But when the first year, Shemitah year with the new Yishuvim came up, so the Jewish farmers, who were almost all religious, went to Rothschild, who'd bankrolled the whole thing, and they told Rothschild he was nuts to put millions and millions of dollars in the 1870s, 80s into Jewish, you know, Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael with the Ottomans and the... So Rothschild said he believed in it, he thought it was the way, you know, whatever. He was secular. So they turned around to Rothschild in 1888 and said, well, thank you for the money, but we're actually not going to do anything now for a year. We can't do anything. He said, like, you're joking, right? He probably never even heard of Shemitah. And they said, no, the Torah says we can't work the land. And he says, well, I've just put $1 million or whatever it is into this. I'm not seeing all that investment completely gone, because it's going to completely destroy everything. So he says, well, we can't do anything. She says, well, you better find a rabbi that says you can. So they went to Rabbi Yitzchak Chonin Spector, who was the main Talmud Chacham in Lithuania at the time. And Rabbi Spector said to them, if you sell the land to a non-Jew for the year, then as far as he's concerned, then that land doesn't have the same kedusha, and you can get non-Jews to work the land, da, 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 and that way you can not let the land just go to ruin. Right? And that became known as the Heter Mechira. Rav Kukwa originally, when it first came out, was in Russia still, and he was quite opposed to it, but by this time he said he had to support it, and he went round to all of these moshavot, who were secular, they couldn't care less about Shemitah, with a document, and he said, right, this is the Heter Mechira, we're going to sell it to Mahmoud, Ahmad, whatever, down the road, and don't worry, fine, it'll be done, and he said, okay, people, okay, crazy rabbi, I was fine, you know, whatever. But he got a lot of flak for this. The rabbis of the old Yishuv said this doesn't work. There was a very, very big fight that he had with someone called the Ritvaz, Rav David Wilensky, I can't remember exactly, up in Fat, and he said, this is a joke, this doesn't work, the Heter Mechira is not serious, and you're selling the land to a non-Jew, and that itself is a problem. Anyway, so up until this day, Shemitah is one of the flashpoints of Hashkafic friction in this country, halachic and hashkafic. More about that another time. Fine. The religious Zionists by this time had set up their own movement called Mizrahi. You heard of Mizrahi? Mizrahi, which it means to the east or forward to the east. It stands for Merkaz Ruchani. We don't just want America as a center which is a Jewish center, we want a religious Jewish center in Israel. And Rav Kook never became part of Mizrahi. In fact, Mizrahi became quite right-wing, and Rav Kook was nervous about it. Mizrahi wrote this whole article saying the Arabs are the enemy, this was the beginning of the Haganah, that kind of defense of the Yishuvim, and Rav Kook says we don't want to antagonize the Arabs, we believe in the paths of peace and brotherhood, even with the Arabs wherever we can. Fine. Okay, he went on other trips around, also with Rabbi Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, who more or less opposed him on almost everything, because he was very much from the old Yishuv. Nevertheless, they went together, they went around. And then 1914 happened.
What happened in 1914, and this is how we're kind of moving forwards fast, in 1914 they set up, in 1912 they set up something called the Aguda, which was really the, what you might call now the ultra-Orthodox or Haredi, the first sort of political movement in Europe to try and defend those positions, which still exist today, right? The Aguda. So they persuaded Rav Kook to come. They were having a big Aguda conference in 1914, and they invited Rav Kook to come. It was in Germany, to address the conference and try and explain to them what's going on in Israel, which was, you know, a great opportunity. Mrs. Kook was pretty unwell. They said to her, you need a break, you need a holiday, go to Germany, you'll be back in a few weeks. So they got on the boat, they went to Germany, they landed in Germany, they got to where they were going, and then the First World War broke out. So then they were stranded, they were stuck. They could not get back to Palestine, as it was then. Rav Kook was also a Russian national, and Russia and Germany were now at war with each other. So Rav Kook was arrested in Germany. He was put into prison. They managed to get him out of prison on the condition he would go to a neutral country. So page 6 now. So they managed to spirit Rav Kook out of Germany, and they got him to Switzerland. He spent a few years in St. Gallen, if I'm pronouncing that right, where he was hosted by someone called Abraham Kimchi. If anybody knows the Kimchi family from London, that's Rabbi Kimchi from London. He is named after this Abraham Kimchi, and that is their family in Rav Kimchi. There's a whole story about the tefillin that Rav Kook gave to Rav Kimchi's father. There's a, not for now, I've got time for that now. But anyway, he was stranded in Switzerland.
He tried to get out. He couldn't. Eventually, he found his way to London. But we'll get to that in a minute. In Switzerland, he met this most unusual person.
Here, look in the middle, this photo of this very interesting young man with very, you know, strong eyes, lots of hair, a rather fetching bowler hat.
This is Rav David Cohen, who grew up religious, went completely non-religious.
He's still alive.
Went to his son just recently died. There are lots of people called Rav David Cohen who are alive, but not this one. Okay, this Rav David Cohen died in the 70s, but
when he met Rav Cook, he was at university in Switzerland. Intellectual thinker, you know. He became a Baal Tshuva, and he became one of Rav Cook's biggest Talmidim,
following him around, writing his stuff down. He became a Nazir. He became such a Baal Tshuva, he became a Nazir, a real life Nazir, which means he didn't cut his hair, he never drank wine. He was a very extreme kind of character. So he met him in Switzerland. Right, London. Rav Cook got to London. In London, he became the Rav of a shul. In London, in Spitalfields. And then in the middle of 1917, the end of 1917, the Balfour Declaration. Now, I don't think it's coincidental that the Balfour Declaration happened when Rav Cook was in London. Mm-hmm. How was Rav Cook ever going to end up living in London? It happened that way, and the Balfour Declaration, which was so unlikely, that there was a government in London which was so unusual for just a few years in the middle of the First World War, and then it reverted back to the same old kind of low-level anti-Semitic, you know, government that they have constantly, and then they wanted to issue this Balfour Declaration, and the Rav Cook was there, and there were the English Jews fighting against it because they were afraid it would leave them open to, you know, dual loyalties and all that kind of stuff, accusations. Anyway, the Balfour Declaration was given, and Rav Cook thought it was unbelievable. He founded his own youth movement, which was completely unsuccessful. Okay? But called Degel Yerushalayim. And by this time, Chaim Weizmann, who of course had a massive class to pay in this, because Chaim Weizmann was a chemical engineer. And Churchill, who was the first Lord of the Admiralty, in the middle of the First World War, he needed explosives to fight for the Navy, to fight against the Turks and the Germans. So someone told him, Weizmann's your man, he can get you your explosives. And therefore Weizmann made contact with Churchill, and that was one of the reasons also for the Balfour Declaration. And Weizmann now got back to Israel, and he said, okay, we're moving forward here, guys. We've got the Balfour Declaration. There's going to be something big going on here. He went to Israel. Everybody was fighting. All the Jews were fighting with each other. The religious Jews were fighting with the religious Jews, and the religious Jews were fighting with the non-religious Jews, and everybody's fighting with the British, and everyone's fighting everybody. And Weizmann said, listen, there's one man that can bring it all together. That's this guy stuck in London. The First World War is now over. Rabbi Cook, if we can bring Rabbi Cook back to Israel, then that'll sort the problems out. Rabbi Cook, of course, theoretically, was still the chief rabbi of Jaffa, although he hadn't been there for the last 5 years. So they said, we're going to make him the chief rabbi of Israel. He came back to Israel. He spent one night in Jaffa, and then he basically took up the position. Go to page 7, please. If we don't get through all this, we'll just finish it off tomorrow morning, because it's too important to not do. Basically, Rav Cook was invited unanimously by a big conclave of rabbis to be the chief rabbi. The British set up a chief rabbinate. The Ottomans were gone. The British were now in charge. And Rav Cook basically stepped into the position of the first Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Israel. The Mizrahi movement said, we're going to have elections, and we need you, Rabbi Cook, to paskin that women can vote. Because the old Yishuv say that women can't vote. They're not allowed to vote. Halachically. So they went to Rav Cook and they asked him, Mishaila, are women allowed to vote in the new Yishuv elections? And the Rav Cook said, no. Which was a big shocker. And they said, really? He went, really. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the reasons why the Mizrahi kind of pulled a little bit away from Rav Cook. And they basically said, in future, on religious matters, we'll ask the rabbis, but on public matters, the rabbis can ask us. This was the religious Mizrahi. Anyway, so Rav Cook was open to accusations of being too frum by some of the people on the left, too right-wing for the left, too left-wing for the right, etc. Jabotinsky, who was now, you know, working very hard to form the Yishuv, also very critical. Ben-Gurion, everybody was pretty critical of Rav Cook. Okay, let's go a little bit further. Rav Cook's main work, Orot, which we'll quote a lot from over the next few days, started to be published. His son became one of his main editors, so did Rav David Cohen, the Nazir. The rabbis of Yerushalayim banned it. They said, quote, it was full of gross things, foreign to the entire Torah, new forms of deviance that our rabbis and ancestors could not have imagined, a sorcerer's book, forbidden to study, let alone rely on all his nonsense and dreams. That's not very friendly, okay? And that remains to a large degree the position of the Haredi community about Rav Kook's work. And they just don't study it at all. But Rav Kook was not put off by this. He pushed forward. There's a cute story that there's a midrash, there's a Kabbalistic idea that when a Talmid Chacham walks alone at night, so then the forces of the evil can get him. So he always has to have accompaniment. Like the Mazikim can get him. So Rav Kook was known. He walks alone at night. He walks and strolled around Jerusalem. So someone once asked him, "Aren't you worried about the Kabbalistic idea that the Mazikim attack Talmid Chachamim?" So he says, "Don't worry, the Mazikim in Yerushalayim don't really think I'm a Talmud Chacham." So he says, "So I'm quite safe." Yeah, fine. Let's just go on a little bit, and then I'll let you have some lunch. He moves into next to Anatiko. Anatiko and Albert Tiko, the Anatiko house. You've been there in Yerushalayim. You must go. It's beautiful. Rav Kook put up his house. He moved next door to her. Fine. Big trip to America. 1924. Rav Kook goes to America to fundraise. He went to Calvin Coolidge in the White House. This is him in D.C. at the top of page 8. He presented him with a poem that he read in the middle of the Oval Office. He read it out in, or wherever they were standing, they read it out in Hebrew, and someone translated it. Calvin Coolidge obviously thought he was a little bit strange, but nevertheless said he was a great rabbi. People came from everywhere to follow them, to cheer Rabbi Cook's big tour of America. He met with Harry Fischel, a big American philanthropist. This is him with a nasty mustache there. Very important donor as well. They raised no money. Okay, but he had a great trip to America, and they came back. Hebrew U was opened 1925. This picture of Hebrew U has got all the greats there. There's Rabbi Hertz, there's Rav Kook, there's Balfour. I think somewhere in there, there's Einstein. They're all there. Rav Kook's big speech on the opening of Hebrew U was unbelievable. If you look at what he thought Hebrew U would become, he was a very big optimist. Maybe you'd say he was naive. But he really felt it was going to be his dream combination. I brought you here Shaul Lieberman, who became very close to Rav Kook as well, later became a major figure in JTS, which is the conservative movement, although he himself was not conservative. Lots of things just leading up to this. I think we can actually do this today, if you give me 2 more minutes. 1929 was the Arab riots. Rav Kook was very shocked by them, but was very involved in supporting the Jewish community. Late 20s, his mother and father, obviously very old by then, passed away. And finally, on page 9, basically when Rav Kook was quite old, he nevertheless was still very much attacked by many people in the old yeshuv and in the new yeshuv. He wrote things which got people made people go wild. He wrote a whole thing about how important it was for Jewish boys to do physical education. Some Jews are not so into physical education, you know? But he even wrote this line where he said that the physical exercises of the young Jewish men in Tel Aviv are as precious to God as the Tehillim in the yeshiva. And his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, says, "You cannot write that. You cannot say that." And he said, "No, I'm going to say it. I'm going to put it in." And he put it in, and they went nuts. They went wild. They were putting, you know, I wrote here, they called him like from the dark side. I mean, this time this was not funny. But they made, you know, fun and mock. They put him on a mock trial. They made all these Kashkavilim, the big things on the walls, saying, you know, everyone has to ban him. They made an effigy of him, which they burnt. You know, it was really, this is religious. This was really, really, really hot stuff. Then Chaim Arlozorov, which was a Labour left-wing politician, was assassinated on the beach of Tel Aviv. And there were a group of right-wing Jewish men who were accused of assassinating him, okay? Rav Kook supported these men, or at least one of them, as being innocent, which immediately made him completely unpopular with all the left-wing. And by the way, the assassination of Arlozorov in 1933 was one of the main sources of the left-right split in Israeli politics, all the way up to today. All the way up to today. And it took until Menachem Begin for the right wing to get back in. But whatever, so Rav Kook was basically losing friends everywhere. He wanted to be the bridge between everybody, but actually he managed to alienate quite a lot of people, even though many, many other people loved him very, very greatly. Look to the last page, I want you to get some lunch. This is Rav Kook quite late in life. He had stomach cancer, he was diagnosed in 1934. They moved him to Kiryat Moshe, which was one of the newest suburbs of Yerushalayim. His house was just up the road here. He had a one-week visit from Rav Soloveitchik, the one and only trip Rav Soloveitchik ever made to Israel in 1935 when he applied to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv and was turned down. The reasons for that as well, but he saw Rav Kook just before he died. Just before he died, they brought him the new title pages for his new Oros HaKodesh, etc. And eventually on the 3rd of Elul, which is very still kept as a yod site, on the 1st of September 1935, Rav Kook died, surrounded by Rav Chalap, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, Rav Issa Zalman Meltzer, many other people. I brought you a picture of the Rav Nazir in the 1960s, Rav Tzvi Yehuda. These people became extremely important for Israeli political thinking, and then through the yeshiva itself at the bottom, which is of course just across the road. So my apologies, we went a few minutes over, but I think it was worth us finishing. With that context in mind, we'll be able to spend the next 3 days looking at Rav Kook's thought. Okay?
Who
an Arab eventually turns out the Arabs killed him. Yeah.